and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back for another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's a pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud's going to take us down the road telling us his personal tales of wrestling history, his wrestling history. Without any further ado, the man himself, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. And Ron, we've had a lot of interesting episodes, but this one is going to talk about a somewhat dangerous episode in your life.
Yes, it is. In fact, I consider this episode's probably the longest and the most dangerous day in my career. A lot of things going to happen in this day, and it's a long day. And, yeah, I just want to jump right into it, man. This is a fabulous story, and it's kind of odd, but it's going to follow a couple of plane crashes that we've done in recent Studcast. And by golly, this one is right up there when I did those programs on those Studcast on the plane crashes, the one with Bobby Shane and the other one with Ric Flair and Johnny Valentine. I got to thinking about this, Rick, again, too, or what's about to happen here. I think fans will really enjoy this. This is kind of like what wrestling was all about 40 years ago and how things were happening and guys were having their own planes and small planes and private planes. And this is just a great explanation, and I think it'll be great. Fans will probably really enjoy this one just because of the danger that's involved in the whole thing. It's not just about planes. It's going to evolve into something much more than just planes. So it's basically, I've wrestled the night before this all begins on a Friday night in Tallahassee. Most unusual, I'm always in Fort Lauderdale because it's near to West Palm. But for some reason, they want me to go to Tallahassee after Jacksonville. Jacksonville ran on Thursday nights, Tallahassee on Friday night, along with Fort Lauderdale. So I'm going to get sent to Tallahassee. I'm going to ride back from Tallahassee with, I think, maybe Jack Briscoe. And he's going to drop me off at a hotel. And at 9 o'clock the next morning, Lester, who's my grandfather Roy's brother, Lester's got his own plane. He's going to fly us to San Juan, Puerto Rico, and we're leaving at 9 o'clock in the morning on out of Tampa. So as you can imagine, this is going to be a long flight, and it's in a small private plane. So we drive across the Howard Franklin Bridge in Tampa to get into St. Petersburg, and we fly. His plane is located in the St. Pete Airport. We get on his plane. It's a 6-passenger plane, but we're going to overload it like we talked about in a couple of other plane crashes here. We're going to overload this King Air that's made for 6 passengers. We're going to put a 7th passenger on it. So when we get on the plane, I'm still kind of tired. I haven't had a long sleep. And Lester, asked me if I want to sit up front with him in the second pilot seat. And I say, no, I believe I'm going to take a seat in the back because I want to sleep a little bit, to be honest with you. So he gets to flying, and I go to sleep. And We're headed down to Fort Lauderdale. We're going to pick up five other guys. We're going to pick up Bob Roop. We're going to pick up Rocky and his brother, Curtis Smith. They are the Infernos at this time frame. Young wrestler, pretty big size guy named Joe Flaherty, and Lester's son, Roy Lee Welch. And it's my second cousin. He's going to be picked up in Lauderdale, too. They're all down there having wrestled in Lauderdale. That happens to be on the way to San Juan. So we're headed out to go down to Lauderdale and pick up more bodies to pile into this plane. And after we leave, I go to sleep. And Lester's a tremendous pilot. I've got to give him credit. I've flown with him many, many hundreds of hours, maybe. Flights back and forth to Nassau in the Bahamas, Freeport in the Bahamas, and other flights into San Juan. This is an unusual flight into San Juan because of what happens during the flight and because what's going to happen later once we get to San Juan. But we're headed down there. I go to sleep. And I hear the tower talking to him. It wakes me up. Somebody's really excited in the tower. And they scream to him and negative. You're at the wrong airport. This is not Fort Lauderdale. This is Hollywood Airport. Pull up, pull up. He's about to land at the wrong airport. And, you know, now Lester never makes a mistake. I hear this and I'm like, whoa, geez. I should have thought right then, you know, Lester having a problem like this early on in the day, that this is just liable not to be a good day. And going forward, I'm going to find out that that's probably an understatement. So we land finally in Lauderdale's airport. We go around, obviously, and there's a lot of, you had to bear in mind, you're in the South Miami. You're close to Miami itself. You've got Hollywood that sits right there. You've got Fort Lauderdale that sits right there. You just have a lot of airports along that coast right there. Small airports, big airports as well. So it's a natural mistake, easy mistake to make. First time Lester, I guess, had been into Lauderdale's airport. So we land and we pick up the other five passengers. And I mentioned their names earlier, but I'm sitting around at this point. I've kind of seen a lot of small planes that are overloaded, and I start calculating the weight of some of my fellow passengers, I guess I could put it that way. And I think, you know, Roop's up there around close to 300, and Curtis Smith is around 300. Rocky Smith, his brother, is a little smaller, but probably he goes 240. I'm in that 260 range. You've got Joe Flaherty. He's about 270. Lester's son's about 230. By the time I'm adding up all these weights and thinking about the bags and things like that and the weight of the bags, I'm figuring there's about 2,000 pounds of passengers we're about to put on the plane. He also has to fill the plane with fuel because we're going to have a seven-hour flight. We're not going to be able to use the bathroom because there's no bathroom on this plane. We're not going to have any leg room. Not for me. I got long legs. I know I'm going to be crammed in on this plane for 7 hours, and it's going to be a real hard trip here. I've already started from Tampa. I've flown for about an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes to get down to Lauderdale. Now you're loading up other passengers. You're filling up the plane, and he's going to distribute the weight. He's a smart pilot. That's been a pilot error for a couple of problems that we've had with earlier flights we've discussed in private planes. And Lester doesn't make that mistake. He distributes the weight like he should. Everybody sits where he tells them to sit. I end up, this is a six-passenger plane. You've got the two pilot seats in the front. Behind those pilots, there's a little partition. And in the next row is two seats, but they sit facing backward. So you face the back of the plane rather than the front of the plane. Then the next two seats behind those face forward so that you've got four guys that are looking at each other. And then in the very back, there's a little jump seat back there. probably not made to be used very often, but Roy Lee gets put on the jump seat in the back. And I'm looking around and thinking, man, before we take off, wow, this is liable to be a difficult thing. And so we take off around 12:15 for this 7-hour nonstop plane ride, no bathroom, no leg room, and the two deafening engines on this King Air that just makes so much noise, you can hardly talk to each other. You can hardly hear anybody speak. And it just so happens that we happen to be going to fly in the Devil's Triangle. Now, I don't know if all the fans out there are familiar with the Devil's Triangle, but the Devil's Triangle is a triangular-shaped geography. It starts in Miami. It goes south to Puerto Rico. It goes from Puerto Rico north to Bermuda. And the third leg of that triangle comes from Bermuda back to Miami. We're going to fly one of the three legs of the Bermuda Triangle, I mean the Devil's Triangle, down there to San Juan. It's a phenomenally dangerous area of the world to fly in for some reason. Planes disappear there, and they have for many, many years, as long as there have been planes flying there. And they've had not just small planes like we're on. They've had commercial flights. They've had actual Navy planes and just big planes and small planes. And for some reason, it is just a really dangerous place on the planet Earth in which to fly. And we're flying one of those legs. So we get on our trip and we're rolling down there. We're probably halfway to San Juan, maybe just a little more than halfway to San Juan. And Lester, in all the trips I've ever flown with him, and this probably, I'm going to guess at this, maybe 40 trips, I've never heard him say a single word. He's like a robot flying a plane. He gets in that plane and he's just focused on what he's got to do, and he's all business. So, never having heard him say anything, he for the first time says something. And what we're sitting there, I've got in front of me is Bob Roop, and the two Smith brothers are sitting facing each other, and we're playing cards. There's a little tabletop there that we're able to sit up in the middle of the plane. It's a little metal pole that holds up the tabletop, and it slides down into a little slot for it and built into the bottom of the plane. And we're playing cards because that's kind of what we do when we get these long flights, is you end up playing cards quite a bit. So we're playing cards. We've been having a pretty decent time. The weather's good. No problems at all. And all of a sudden, Lester decides that I need to say something. And he turns around. He's very, very quiet, Lester, anyway. He's a funny type of guy. He doesn't get excited. He's very laid back and low key. And he turns around and he says, Roy, break out that life raft back there. Just like that. I mean, very calm, not dramatic at all. You know, just break out that life raft back there. And we all look at each other and like, Did he really say what he thought we said? Did he say break out the life raft? And we're like, whoa, but because Lester doesn't talk to anybody, we're hesitant to talk to Lester, it's not like flying on a commercial plane where you have a problem and eventually the pilot's going to come on and you're going to say, ladies and gentlemen, we got a problem and here's what it is. Well, with Lester, you don't get an update. You don't get that type of thing. So finally, we quit playing cards because our cards are sticking to our hands. Like, what's going on here? And so I finally got to ask him, I say, Lester, what's wrong? And he's very quiet for about 20 seconds. And then he says, we're losing the oil pressure in the left engine. And so I don't know what that means. None of us know what that means. I know that I'm sitting on that side of the plane when we fly into Fort Lauderdale, and I know that engine is just as clean as the engine on the other side of the plane. And I look out, I happen to be sitting next to that engine, and about 2 yards away is that engine, and it's half of it is black now. And I'm like, whoa, geez, man. Wow, that don't look good. So we fly along. Everybody stop playing cards because the cards are getting sweat because we're nervous. Everybody's concerned about this at this point, you know. So finally, I ask again. I have another question, and I say, Lester, can we lose that engine? Can we fly on one engine? Another about 20-second pause, and he goes, no. I was like, whoa. I mean, that really makes us feel good. Now we're like, oh, are you kidding me? You know, so I get to starting. Everybody gets quiet. And we don't even talk to each other. Now we're just looking at each other and looking out that window constantly. Everybody's focused on that engine that's getting blacker by the minute. It's just getting darker and darker because there's obviously a problem in that engine. And so I start trying to calculate. Well, where are we by this point, you know? And I know a little about the Caribbean because I've wrestled down in there and I've been to San Juan. So I'm thinking, you know, well, we're probably pretty far east of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. We're south of Cuba for sure. And down below Cuba, you got Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And then off to our west is the Turks and the Caicos Islands. I'm thinking about where's an airport, you know? I mean, surely he's already thinking about this. You know, where are we going to land this thing if we can't fly and we're going to crash? Where are we going to put this thing down? Because you're up there in that plane and you can't see anything but water in all directions. Occasionally you see a small little tiny island, but there's no people on it, much less an airport. And to have an island big enough to have an airport on down in that part of the world, it just doesn't happen very often. So we're really in a bad way here. I mean, this is like, we keep thinking about it. Nobody's willing to talk about it. We don't want to speak about it. We don't want to go, what do you think? I mean, what are we going to do? Everybody's just silent. So we continue to fly, and it's looking like a bad situation. It starts to get dark. It's late in the afternoon. There's just nothing out there. I mean, you just continue to fly. Now that engine is starting to sputter a little bit. You got to that kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, my gosh, man. You know, nobody's asking him any more questions because I'm afraid to ask him at this point. It could get worse. He might give me an even worse answer. So we fly on, and it finally gets to where the sun has gone down, and it's dark. You know, and so I ask him, finally, I say, Kent, Lester, are we going to be able to make it to San Juan? And another pause, and same answer, no. I was like, oh, man, come on. I mean, like, I want to say, you got to tell us something here, Lester. I mean, what's going on? What's your plan here? Do we have a plan? I want to start into it, but, you know, I'm just... He's just doing that robot thing up there. And so I finally, it gets dark, and I see some lights through. I look out from the front around me. I can see out the front window, and I see some lights on the horizon. And I'm like, wow, we're going to get to an island. He's got a plan. I mean, we are going, something good is going to happen, you know? And so I'm thinking, you know, when I thought about the Cuba deal, maybe he could turn around and he could go back to the Dominican Republic, or he could even go back and somehow get into Cuba, maybe even, you know. So I got that in the back of my mind. I don't think that we've turned, made any directional changes, but we might have, and I wouldn't noticed it. Maybe I wouldn't have noticed it because everybody's just focused on that engine. So it's dark. I see lights of a runway, and I'm like, oh, man, that's beautiful. I'm like, wow, this is, I can't tell you how pretty those lights saw on that runway. All of us, we're like, whoa, yeah, oh, gosh, we are going to land. He doesn't tell us anything. He doesn't say, hey, we're here, there, or where we are, or anything like that. And we land. And once we land, we taxi down this long runway. I can tell it's an extremely long runway. We just seem like we taxied forever. And then he stops on the actual runway. And I'm thinking, well, that's kind of strange. But I'm sitting right by the door. And it's one of those King Airs. And you had a little dial that you could almost dial it and turn it clockwise. It would unlock the door, and then you could grab a rope and lower the stairs to get off the plane. Well, man, as soon as that plane comes to a stop, I want to get my ass off there. I'm done with this, man. I want to get off this plane. And so I jump off the plane, and I'm the first one out, obviously. And I look up, and we are surrounded by Army guys with machine guns. The whole plane. I'm like, oh, my gosh almighty, what in the world is this all about? You know, I mean, so the other guys come off, and I'm sure their thoughts are the same. They're like, whoa, geez, you know. So my first thought is, well, he did turn around, and we're in Cuba, and we're going to prison. Well, he goes, you know, you don't fly into Cuba. It'll let you fly and land there. So it turns out that it's a strategic air command base on the eastern side, on the western side of Puerto Rico. San Juan's on the eastern tip. On the western side is a SAC air base, a strategic air command, in which it's all B-52s. They have the old B-52s that are loaded with the bombs and the whole deal. And so when they pull up this van and they put us in the van, and they drive us back down that runway. And the plane is there. They're towing the plane into to a hangar there. And when we start driving down that runway, I'm just freaked out by these huge monster B-52s. And I know what they're all about. And, you know, nobody said this is a SAC base, but I kind of figured out, man, this is not Cuban planes. Those are B-52s. And so we get to talking, me and Roop and a couple of us, you know, and I go, geez, man, we got to be in some kind of SAC base or some kind of air command base or something. So they take us back. They wheel the plane into a hangar, and they start repairing the plane right away, working on the plane. But they take us, and they put us in this waiting area. It's a pretty good-sized waiting area, but They leave two armed guards with the machine guns in there with us. And if you want to use the bathroom, you have to ask them permission, and they send somebody with the machine gun to follow you. So they watch you the entire time that you're there. And if you go to the bathroom, they go watch you. They stand inside the bathroom. If you've got to go in a stall, they're standing right there. I mean, their security is big time there. And obviously we don't belong there. So what's happened is he makes these calls, I guess, into the strategic end. They hook him up. We've got a problem. We're about to go down. There's nothing they can do except allow us to make an emergency landing there. Pretty big, spectacular event. I doubt they get a whole lot of private planes that make landings at that base, that air base. So we're still an hour out of San Juan. It takes them about 45 minutes to an hour to fix the plane. Now, the matches are supposed to start in San Juan at 8 o'clock, and they put us back on the plane. We still got almost an hour to fly. They stick us on the plane, and we're still 45 minutes away. And so I'm thinking, you know, heck, we're not, you know, they're going to tell people that we're whatever, and they're going to give their money back, and that'll be the end of it. But he says, no, he says, you know, I already called them up. I've got in touch with them there. They already announced to the crowd what's going on, that there's a plane full of wrestlers that are had a problem, and they're at the far end of the island, and they'll be here within an hour. And so they talked these fans into staying for an additional hour. Now, these are Puerto Rican fans, and they're wild and crazy. It's pretty much like the Bahamas. It's not very much different, especially this is the early days of wrestling in San Juan and in Puerto Rico. So the crowd is they're wild to begin with, and they were in a baseball stadium. The baseball stadium is it has dugouts. Obviously, it has dugout on each side of the field, on each baseline, and the babyface is dressed on one side, and the heels dressed on another. And for those heels, they have a fence that goes around for foul balls that protects you down to just about where the dugout starts. But that fence stops where the dugout starts. So when I'd been to Puerto Rico and worked in this baseball stadium before, but when we arrived there, there's still 20,000 people there, and they are just raucous as hell. They're aggravated because they've been waiting an hour for any matches whatsoever, and they're crazy to begin with. So I'm thinking, gosh, man, this is liable to get it. The plane flight has been just horrible and stressful as could possibly be, but this is liable to be even worse before it all goes down.
And we will find out shortly a little bit about why it is not a good idea to have 20,000 aggravated fans in an arena. But first, let's go to this break and a few words about Super Studcast number 9, Wrestling Riots.
Studcast fans, we want to thank each and every one of you, our worldwide listeners, for your phenomenal support of the most unique wrestling podcast on earth. Ron Fuller's Studcast is chronological in its delivery, generational in its subject matter, and absolutely astounding in its stories. No wonder the world is now considering the Stud to be one of the premier wrestling historians alive. And speaking of unique, that is exactly what Super Studcast number 9 is about, Wrestling Riot. Now available, it takes fans behind closed doors into the sport's dark and dangerous side, where fans and wrestlers collide in a real fight for life. The Stud tells stories of his own bone-chilling experiences at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for 3 hours, and you too will feel the adrenaline of this unforgettable ride into wrestling history. Now, we continue with Studcast number 61 with your host, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, and Brian Last.
There it is, Super Studcast number 9, Wrestling Riots, available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast, only $2.99. Check that out right now. We'll have more information at the end of the program. Ron, we had a little bit of a tease as we were going to the commercial break, and I said that it can't be a good situation to be in when you have 20,000 aggravated and crazy fans, as you put it. What was the reality of the situation? What was it like that night in Puerto Rico?
Well, the baseball, it's in a baseball stadium. It probably holds 25,000, but we got 22,000. The figure I happened to ask Lester later, how many people stayed, it was 22,000, had purchased a ticket, and it looked like the whole stadium was full to me. So a lot of fans are still there. And the way this stadium works, and wrestling in Puerto Rico is dangerous. It's just like the Bahamas, maybe even worse in some ways. And this baseball stadium was really, really a scary place for heels for certain, because as I explained briefly, the backstop for foul balls to protect people only went down to about the first baseline, where the first base was. The dugout started there, and so there was no protection. There was no wire or anything to protect you as a wrestler. And what happens there in Puerto Rico, this is different than any place I've ever been in the world, is they throw the rocks. But they throw more than just the rocks like they do in Nassau. They throw boards, they throw knives, they throw whatever they've got, because the wrestler leaves the dugout. He's got about a 20-foot distance that he has to – you can't walk that 20 feet because they're waiting on you. They know the routine, The fans come all the time. They bring the boards with them, or they find the boards. They find whatever, the rocks, whatever they're going to throw, and they wait on that heel. Once they ring the bell, he gets underneath the dugout, and I used to watch him because I'm on the opposite side of the third baseline in the babyface area, and I see him position themselves where the crowd can't see them. They're standing inside the dugout, and they're getting up the nerve to make that run for about 20, 25 feet. That's the only chances they have to hit you. Once you get that far past that distance, then the foul line fences are going to protect you. They can't throw through those fences. So they're all standing up there close to the dugout. They're all ready and prepared. They've got their stuff. And that's the way it worked when you worked San Juan. Those poor heels, they would get up on that top step. They would keep their back into the dugout so that the fans couldn't see that where they were. And then they would, man, I take a running start. They would run like crazy, and everything would come flying out onto the field. Never saw anybody get hit, but gosh, I always was amazed at how much stuff was thrown at them and how bad it could be. Now, they also had to deal with this when the match was over. They got to get back to that certain point. And what happened in that case is they would walk slowly. As long as they're protected by the foul line fences, they would walk slowly, and then they knew just about where the point is that they need to run, because everything is still laying out there on the field that's been thrown at them when they went out. So they get right to that point, and now, I mean, they just bust for that dugout. They just, as fast as they can get there, to keep from just getting killed by something, hit by a concrete block, whatever those people could find, they wanted to throw them at you. So it happens now. We're about three matches in. Now they've waited. We don't start. The matches don't even start. It's supposed to start at 8 o'clock. They don't even start till probably 9:30. And they've got 22,000 people there. They've been sitting and waiting, aggravated, and they sell beer there, which is, oh, my, that's a kiss of death. Now they've had more time to drink beer than ever, and more time to get themselves all riled up and to get their courage up and to just get nasty as they could possibly be. So we get to about the third match of the night, not the end of the night, but it's around the third match. And it's lucky for Dale Lewis that it is the third match and not the last match, where some of the guys might have caught the taxi and gone to the hotel or gone on wherever they were staying. So it's third match. Dale Lewis gets on the steps. I see him do the deal, and he makes the dash to protection area, and he stops, and he walks slowly onto the rest of the ring. They have the end of the match. Fans are mad. I think he wins that match because no people sit out there on the field like you would in a baseball stadium, for instance, like the one in Atlanta, in which my dad wrestled Mario Galento with 38,000 people. At least 15,000 people are out there on the field. So you don't get that. You don't have that to deal with. There's just the ring sitting out there. So he gets finished with his match. He goes over. He wins. He comes back. He walks very slowly till he gets to the point that he has to make the dash. And when he starts, about four guys, I'd never seen this happen, and he had never seen it happen too. And I think this is why he gets in the position that he's going to get into, is about three or four of those guys jump out of the stands, and they jump onto the top of the dugout, and they're throwing stuff at him, but he gets about halfway to where they are, and for some reason, he panics, or whatever happened, he stops. And when he stops, it just makes all the others that are standing in the stands behind them, it gives them the guts to come out there too. So instead of the three or four that, if they had jumped off and got in front of him, he would have been able to barrel over them and make it to the dugout and safety. but he stopped, he hesitates. And when he hesitates, about 10 more guys jump out onto the top of the dugout, and then two or three of them jump off between him and the dugout. And now I'm there. I'm a young guy. There's a lot of young guys. Bob Roop's a young guy at this point. Joe Flaherty's a young guy. Roy Lee's a young guy. We're all baby faces at this point. And we're like, wow, what's going to happen here? You know, but Dale panics, and he could have bowled over two or three of those guys, gotten to the dugout. Everything would have been cool. But he panics and he stops. And when he stops, the crowd jumps on. More people jump onto the top of the dugout. And then he turns and he runs. And he runs out toward left field in the ballpark. Now, the dugout is on the right field line that he's trying to go into. So he's running the opposite field. And all that just... Now you got three or four guys, they start to chase him, and now here they come. Literally hundreds of them come out onto the top of the dugout and jump off on the field, and they start after him. So we're like, oh my gosh, man, what's going to happen now? I mean, we're you know, they're going to kill you there. Those people don't care. They won't stop. So they chase him, and he runs out to left field, to the fence. And he tries to climb over the fence, but he sees that he can't do it. It's going to be too tall, too high. So he turns to the right. Now, the whole crowd, it's really strange. It's kind of like watching a cartoon in a way. They all follow him. They all run across the same where he ran. They follow him down that left field line. And then when he gets to the wall, he turns right. He's got nothing. He's got nowhere to go. He's got to run to center field. And they all run to left field. They all follow him then to center field. And then he runs to right field. But he's still out there by the fence. He's not turned back to head back toward the dugout at all. Now, when he gets to the right field fence out there, he's got no place to go. They're coming for him. They're out there at center field. They ain't that far from him now. And then there are people coming off the dugout now that are headed straight for him. I look at it right then. I'm a young guy, and I say, Dale Lewis is dead. He's never going. So we leave. We go do what you do in a riot. All the heels come out of that dugout, and they go for him. They go out there to where he is. And, hell, we all are baby faces. We go, too. You know, we're going to try to save him. We got to go save him. He's not going to make it. He can't fight his way through all this mob. And we just start knocking people down. I mean, you're not nice and cordial, and you don't push them out of the way because they're really wanting to get him. And now he's really running toward us, and the crowd is following him, and some of them are in front of him, and the heels don't have a problem. They can knock out people all day long. They're not going to have a problem. When you start as a baby face defending a heel in a riot, you're really putting yourself in jeopardy because they'll realize that why is he helping him? You know, they think you ought to be trying to beat him up too, just like they are. So we start laying out bodies. I mean, you're just hitting people and down they go, down they go, down they go. We get to where he is and we get around him. The heels get around him and we fight all the way back to that dugout. And once they get to the dugout, heels go in the dugout. And we just come right back quickly. We run back to our dugout because now the crowd's really inflamed. They wanted to get him, and they thought they were going to get him, and they didn't get a hand on him. But it was, to me, one of the most, could have been the worst riot that I'd ever seen. It turned out to be, he didn't get hurt. But I have seen a lot easier and lighter situations in which fans get to take control, and it just becomes a nightmare for heels and a nightmare for baby faces, too. And this, you know, we're going to talk about this in the Super Studcast, all the wrestling riots that I've been in, and my dad as well. It's kind of a little lead up to that what that's all about. And it's a phenomenally dangerous situation. And when you're in a foreign country and you're dealing with people that just don't care, life doesn't mean much to some people in some parts of the world. And it's easy to take a life. You know, they got a knife. They'll stick that knife in you and they won't worry about it. They'll be happy that they did it. And just a terrible situation was averted there, and really, really lucky for everybody.
Did you guys spend the night in San Juan?
No. No, we did not. And I was kind of happy we did not, as a matter of fact. But we weren't scheduled to. Now, this is not only, like I said at the beginning of this podcast, this is not just dangerous because of the flight. It's a horribly long day. We're going to go back and get on that plane again that we've had trouble with earlier in the day. And we've spent that time at the Strategic Air Command base getting it fixed. And we've got now to get back on that plane, the same seven guys, and we're going to fly another 5 hours north back into the most northernmost island in the Bahamas, to Freeport in the Bahamas, where we're going to wrestle the next night. So we've had a pretty nasty day so far, man. From the 9 o'clock time I got up in the morning, we've had a pretty nasty day. We've got that long, horrible, stressful flight. We've got a riot. And now we're getting on the plane again, and we really don't know at this point. Is the plane going to get us there? Is it not going to get us there? And so we leave flying out of there, the five of us, and the seven of us. And we're out there, and Lester goes, I've never seen this before, because he'd spent a very stressful day himself, obviously. He's responsible for us, did a great job of getting us on the ground somewhere alive. And now he's blown up. So about 2 hours into the flight, 3 hours into the flight, he goes to sleep. And he's the pilot, right? He sets his, but the plane set on autopilot, and he just goes to sleep. He lays his head back on the back of his seat, and we're all kind of sleeping until we realize that the pilot's asleep. And everybody else on the plane then woke up. Everybody's looking at each other like, man, dang, Lester's asleep. He's asleep up there. You know, it's like, what's going to happen? So we're flying along. We're all awake. Our pilot's asleep. And all of a sudden, the plane starts going, and it starts to take a nosedive. It's like, whoa, my gosh, man. The problem we thought we were going to die from earlier today has come back again, we figure, you know. And this time we're nosediving. And Lester's still asleep. So everybody at once goes, Lester, Lester, hey, the plane. And he wakes up. And he was so calm and everything. This is one of the great maneuvers that I ever saw him do. He wakes up and he turns back and he looks at us all, and he's got a pissed off look on his face, like, what are you guys? What are y'all, a bunch of wusses? And he reaches down and he flips on the auxiliary tank. The tank had run out of gas. He flips on the auxiliary tank. And then he just puts his head back down and goes back to sleep. And the plane is still nosing. Yeah, it's nosed over going, and we're like, oh, Lester, we're going to get, he just doesn't even respond anymore. And the plane starts going, and the gas starts to come back to the engine, and then the plane starts to go, levels out, and then it starts to climb back to its altitude. And we're looking at each other like, oh man, he's just too cool. You know, it's like he never ever got nothing panicked him, and we're all panicking like crazy. So we got that to deal with, and we finally land in Freeport. Somehow during the night, maybe after the ride and before we got to the plane, Joe Flaherty, he's a young guy. He's a kind of a beginner, and he somehow has got him some beers. And he drinks his beers. Nobody else on the plane got anything to drink. And we're all drinking water or Gatorade or whatever we got. We got a little cooler there, and it's about out of everything by this point. And so Joe's been drinking, and Lester doesn't drink. Lester's he's a straight-laced guy. And so he's a little perturbed. He hears Flaherty in the back, I guess, in the early part of the trip, and he realizes that Flaherty's had a few beers. And I don't know, maybe him and Flaherty don't get along. I don't know what all's going on at this point, but we land in Freeport. We taxi to the little terminal there, and everybody gets off. Flaherty is up front with him. So Flaherty, Lester gets off the plane. Everybody's out of the plane except for Flaherty. Now, he has to maneuver around the seat and put his feet over to get into the aisleway because you're up there in a second pilot seat, and you've got all those foot pedals down below you, and it's a little hard to get out of that seat. So he finally makes his way out of that seat, and he gets back to the opening. Now, the plane sits up about 4 feet, I would guess, at least 4 feet off the runway. It may be even a little more than 4 feet off the runway. He's the last guy off. Lester's down on the tarmac with us. And he comes up into the door of the plane. And he's kind of grabbed both sides of the door, and he's weaving and bobbing and weaving. He's had a little too much to drink. And he goes, "Hey, what's the big hurry?" or whatever he says. And Lester just kind of pushes everybody out of the way. And he goes up to the edge of the stairs, and he reaches up and grabs Flaherty, and like he was going to arm drag him, and he does. He arm drags him off that 5 foot high platform onto the concrete. We all couldn't help but laugh. I mean, it was funny to start with, and then I got to thinking, gosh, man, he might be hurt, you know. And he didn't get up for a little bit. He laid there and sold it pretty good. We're all laughing at him, and Lester just goes on to the terminal. He's not going to wait to see if he's all right or anything else. I mean, he got to do his little deal. He got him off his plane, and he did it in a real nasty way. We end up going to the hotel. Now it's about 5 o'clock in the morning. And I've started at 9 that same day, at 9 in the morning. It's just been an unbelievable trip. I left at 9 at Tampa at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I end up at a hotel in Freeport in the Bahamas at 6 o'clock in the morning the following day. We've flown 2,300 miles. We've been in two countries, the U.S. and Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is kind of a part of our country, but it's certainly very far removed from the country. It's like being in Hawaii. We've had two countries. We've made four landings. It's just been and we've dealt with a tremendous amount of stress. It's just been a horrible day, just terrible.
Was Freeport similar to Nassau? I mean, we spent so much time on the show talking about your experiences in Nassau. How similar was it to Freeport?
It's pretty much exactly the same. I don't think they had as many rocks there. They didn't throw quite as many rocks. But it was still a crowd that you had to be very concerned with. And it was a smaller type of arena. It was an outside venue. And when we get there to wrestle that night, it's raining. And I mean, it's not just like a little rainstorm. It's like a tropical storm going on. And I mean, it starts raining about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it rains. We get to this arena about 7 o'clock at night. Match is supposed to start at 8, and it's just flooded and raining so hard that once you actually get in the ring, you can't hardly see the crowd in the first or second row. because the rain is just going sideways. And they got a pretty decent crowd. I'm amazed that anybody at all is there and would even come and buy a ticket, much less sit in that type of weather and watch an event. But they're there anyway. And so we get to, you know, and Nassau's ring was like, I think when I described it, it's about 24 by 24. It was one of the biggest rings I ever saw in my life. And it was hard. It had concrete blocks underneath it to hold up the plywood. This ring is totally opposite. It's soft and it has nothing to hold up anything underneath. And when you got into the ring, the water, when you stood in the corner, the water was above your wrestling boots. It was like wrestling in a bathtub or wrestling in a pool. You know, and when you got taken down in the middle of it or slammed in the middle of it, your whole body went under. You were underneath the water and people couldn't see you, but they couldn't see you anyway. You know, a bad part about it is it's raining like crazy and they can't see you anyhow. So it doesn't make any difference whether you're underwater or where everybody could be able to see you. They can't see you because of the rain. So somebody got a hammerlock on me. I can't remember. It was a tag match, and somebody got a hammerlock on me, and they took me down in the middle of the ring. So in the middle of the ring, because the ring was sagging, that was the deepest part of the water. So my head was underwater, and I would get a mouthful of water, and I would turn around and spit it up into the air. The two guys that were on the apron, they could see what was going on. They were all laughing, and the referee was laughing. Well, this is part of a big joke. I mean, wrestling in that type of atmosphere, it is a big joke. I mean, you might as well have fun because you're not meant to work like that. You're not meant to wrestle in an environment like that, especially with that type of rain going on and in a ring that's just as horrible as that ring was. So it just epitomized everything about the Bahamas, and this San Juan night epitomized everything about wrestling in the Caribbean. You just did not know what to expect, and you certainly were going to be, scared. You're going to be almost killed on a night like this. You could have been killed on a night like this. So you've seen everything when you wrestled in the Bahamas. This could only happen at the time frame 40 years ago or something like that. Nowadays, that would never probably happen anymore. But I remember this was probably 46 years ago that this night took place. And it was a tremendous experience. That whole trip was horrifying.
Whatever happened to Joe Flaherty?
Joe, I don't know. I've never been able to keep up with him, and nobody seems to know. I think Joe was a local boy that may have trained some, not in the snake pit, because that wasn't really a training venue so much as guys going in there and shooting. There was four or five of us that went there and just shot. We didn't invite Marks down to try to teach him anything. We were trying to learn from each other how to be tougher. And how to use different holes and things like that. So, but a lot of guys did come there eventually, and they did start training. They did not train with that snake pit mentality. That wasn't the deal. If you were going to be trained, guys would treat you good normally. They would not try to hurt you, and they would try to be nice and proper with you, and not put you through too much. Back in the day, that's the way they used to train you. And I think Joe got trained there. I think he was a Tampa boy. He got to where he made a few shots. I think he was probably only in the business that I'm aware of for maybe only about a year. And somehow he disappeared, or he went somewhere else and maybe made a name for himself. But I never heard of Joe Flaherty again after that run in Tampa. In the Florida territory, somewhere between 72 and 73, he disappears, and I never heard about him anymore after that.
At any point, did you consider learning how to fly?
Well, I did a little bit on occasion. My son, I have a son that's 6'10", and he learned to fly. And he quit. My dad learned to fly, And my dad took me one time. I flew with my dad, and he had an airport on his farm in just north of Memphis in a little town called Bolivar. He had a 2,000-acre farm that had an airport on it, a running runway, and he could land his plane there and take off from there, and he talked me into flying with him. And I had flown with some pretty good pilots. I'd flown with some lousy ones, too. You know, I got Ron Wright stories, and I got Lester stories. You got the ends of the spectrum there. And Dad was kind of toward that Ron Wright end of the spectrum. He was not as experienced, and I felt a little uncomfortable flying with him. And and up until then, I was really kind of thinking about it because I was making long trips out of Knoxville, and they were using me in Louisville, Kentucky, and Memphis, which is quite a ways from Knoxville, and the state of Tennessee is a pretty broad state. You know, other places, I get to Dallas sometimes out west, working in Arkansas or even up in St. Louis. And there were times when I thought, you know, maybe I ought to think about a plane, but, you know, I never really got to the point where I wanted to. My son didn't stay at it very long, and it wasn't long that my dad kept flying. I think he had a bad experience. I asked him one time, you know, what happened to your plane? He said, well, I just had a bad experience one time, and I just decided that it probably wasn't worth it. Those small planes can be extremely dangerous, and I guess the worst part about them is how collapsible they are with a crash. If you're in a commercial jet, you've got a lot of steel around you. When you're in those planes, you've got that little tin can stuff around you, and you know that stuff smashes and mashes and mangles you, and it's just very, very dangerous to fly in private planes.
They say that when you're a boat owner, the best days are the day you buy the boat and then the day you sell the boat. Is it similar with a plane?
Well, it probably is. And I don't think you ever make money, obviously, on a plane. It's kind of like a boat. Now, boats I've had, I love boats. But, you know, I had a friend that one time I had a boat, and it was a 33-footer. It was a really nice boat. And we were sitting on a dock. He was filling my tank for me, and it was at a marina. And he said, do you know what boat stands for, B-O-A-T? I said, no, I don't. And he said, break out another 1,000. So, you know, I mean, and the planes are kind of the same way. You know, they're always needing that maintenance and, you know, the upkeep. And sometimes it's not worth it. And in the case of that flying, it's a lot more dangerous, obviously, than being in a boat. But, you know, it's extremely hard to deal with that constant pressure and that constant concern about something going wrong and it being your last flight.
As we wrap up your story today, Ron, is there any way we could do a summation of exactly how long the day was in terms of hours and how many miles you traveled?
Yeah. We traveled about more than 2,000 miles. It's a long way down there to Puerto Rico, and you're in a King Air. It's going to fly at least 250 miles an hour. So, you know, you're in 7 hours. You've got about 1,500, 1,600 miles. You're going back north into the Bahamas, and you're flying another 5 hours. I'm thinking that, you know, probably we flew in excess of 2,400, 2,500, maybe even close to 3,000 miles in that one day. Starting out early, leaving from Tampa, going down to San Juan and getting back on and going up there to Freeport. That was probably close to 3,000 miles. And, you know, we made four landings. We had a landing and we weren't supposed to have. We landed in Lauderdale. We land again in the SAC base. We land again in San Juan, and then we land again in Freeport on the same trip. It's just, and you got all that stress when you're on a plane and you have something like that happen. I got a lot of plane stories. Some of them are commercial flights that are just horrifying. I've just been in terrible situations on planes. It's not as bad, I don't believe, when you're on a commercial flight. I guess you just have more people around you, and more consolation maybe that the fact that this thing is made out of steel and that these pilots are very experienced or whatever it is. But that flying on those small planes it's a scary little deal, and you never get used to it enough to where it's something that you feel comfortable with. I don't think I ever got on a small plane that I didn't feel uncomfortable.
As we wrap things up, we want to remind you that you could become friends with the Stud on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. You can find out all about the Tennessee Stud on his website, tnstud.com. From every episode of the Studcast to the Super Studcast, the rest of the story, souvenirs, fan comments, and the gallery of wrestling photos, tnstud.com is the place to go. And on the topic of the Super Studcast, we want to remind you, Super Studcast number 9, Wrestling Riots, is now available. You can get it at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99. Ron, I want you to tell us where we're going next week, but I know you wanted to thank the fans because the reaction we've been getting for the Super Studcast has been through the roof.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I kind of expected fans would want to hear about Wrestling Riots, and I really love this program. Not the topic. The topic is very dangerous, and it's a bone-chilling deal. Riots are nothing fun about a riot. Although sometimes when it's over, you get in the dressing room and you've seen something in that riot that's funny. You know, it's really strange how that works out. But this Wrestling Riot Super Studcast, 12 of these 16 incidents that I'm going to do in this program, that I've done in that program, is about my personal riots I have been in, 12 of them. And they run the gamut from practically nothing to big time in Panama City in 70-78. So I think fans will really, really find that you see wrestling from a different point of view when you think about it in the context of riot. And I'm really pleased with it, and fans have really enjoyed it. Got great comments in the first days, and it's just been great. And I look forward to fans taking that and listening to that one, because it's really good. Now next week, Brian, I think what I want to do, I've been talking about Australia, but I believe I want to cover the Atlanta War. It's right in this same time frame before I move on to Australia. It has a lot to do with my family. And it is one of the biggest wrestling wars in history. It's unique in so many ways. The fact that my family is involved in it, I think that has some allure to me to do something on the Atlanta Wars, even though... And I'm actually going to be a part of it. My brother's a part of it. The Welches are a part of it. So we're going to give that a go. That might even be 2 episodes. I don't know how long that will last. And I'm sorry not to get to any questions today. We've had I wanted to cover all this because it was just a horrible day for me. This podcast we've just finished, and next week. I want to tackle the Atlanta Wars, and I know you know a lot about that, Brian.
Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction. For another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.